I have two readings today. One is very short. It's from William Blake, a poem called Auguries of Innocence. To see the world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. The second from Barbara Pescan. Thou. I smile when I say it. Thou meaning all that is inside me and outside me. Sometimes a tree and sometimes mountains, or the running doe or the leaping heart of a finch between my palms, or a child's hand no bigger than a tulip flower with no space in it yet for fear, resting in my own. Thou, thou that listens to our tentative and doubting dreams, thou, hear us into certain song, how we are touched by the neighbors and our kin who love us, how we are touched by their sorrows, their healing, their hopes, how we are moved to live more fully by their lives. Thou, thou that listens, thou that cares, thou within, thou beyond, thou in a silence we carry with us all day long. We whisper the names of our people, broken and healing, with us and separated, struggling and reborn. May we all be held by someone, by something, something like hands enfolding the pulse and flutter of a bird, gently, carefully, and slowly opening. Thou, let it be. Amen. When John and I were first dating, this was 5 years ago, I guess, I would go and visit him at his apartment in New Jersey. I lived in Chicago, and he lived in New Jersey, and we'd all be hopping on planes every 6 weeks or so to go see each other. And you have to understand that this apartment was an apartment where a single guy lived, and so it was simple. It was beautiful, but very simple. And in fact, almost everything in that apartment was one color, blue. And the idea behind it, as I understand it, which absolutely worked, is that if everything were the same color, nothing could clash. And so in those times, it worked, I know. It wasn't a bad idea. So I would go and visit him in that blue apartment, and he would go off to school and learn really good things that would help him do, you know, all the smart, wonderful things he does. And I would stay at home staring at all the blue things and worrying furtively about what life was going to be like after graduate school and just how the heck I was going to be able to come up with a fresh new metaphor every single Sunday for people like you. Because I knew then, and I know now, that the best a preacher can ever do is offer up a useful metaphor, a particular slant on a worthwhile message, a window into something bigger than any sermon can be. And I sat there among the blue things thinking about this, and I found myself drawn to one particular blue thing in his apartment. It was a print. It was a print of a painting. It was a field of flowers, mostly blue, on an unclear surface. And I thought just then that maybe I had found a decent metaphor, and I decided that surely I needed to go see the original of the painting for myself. And I'll invite you in this sermon, try to picture what I'm doing. It's a sermon about an image, not a sermon with a point so much. So try to follow the image with me. This painting hangs in the Art Institute of Chicago. And I remember the day that I went to see it. I came in off the busy city street with a couple of hours to kill. If you've ever been to that museum, you know that it's this imposing fortress of artistic metaphor. There are stone lions outside that guard it, and it's easy to feel small and overwhelmed in such a place. So I walked in there in my tennis shoes and I walked sort of tentatively past all of these amazing visions of people's metaphors. I walked past those stretched and tortured contours of El Greco's Christ. I walked past the ancient curves and shattered remnants of old marbles, past swords and armor that had borne the bloody grime of history. And more small and more overwhelmed than when I arrived, genuinely looking for something among all this apparent genius that had a real message for our lives, I walked by all of that, bewildered by the sheer magnitude, the sheer drama of everything around me. You can imagine an art museum on the grandest scale possible. The artists in those galleries tackle everything that matters. Love, war, faith, death, injustice, revenge, everything, every emotion a person is capable of having is there in an art museum, set in stone and paint. It was all too large to comprehend, too vast to relate to in any depth, so I kept moving. 15 minutes among the Renaissance masters ought to do it. A half an hour trying to figure out why this neon installment in the modern wing was such a piece of brilliant artwork. 5 baffled minutes trying to figure out why they gilded the interior of Egyptian sarcophagi. When finally I settled down, cross-legged on the floor in front of what I had come to see. This painting, if you can imagine it, is a canvas of unparalleled simplicity and expansive vision. Like my life, like most of our lives, this painting is beautiful and totally unclear. It is nothing more than a fuzzy field of speckled mellow blue resting uneasily in a golden frame. There is no point of reference in this painting. There is no villain, no hero, no clue as to the scope of this floating blueness, and out of the fog, all that is really visible first is shadow. Until you look more and more, until you can finally see something, planet or proton, you don't quite know, but something floating in there on that serene, impressionist surface. Now think about it. An image like that, an artistic creation that has utterly no clarity, that can be puzzling, even infuriating. We know that when confronted with lack of clarity, the human brain gets all freaked out. It buzzes mightily, trying to apply order and definition to everything that is blurry. But this image that I'm describing, this image will not clear up and line up rank and file according to the urgings of anybody's logical mind. Rather, it sits there, like our lives, shamelessly blurry, and yet oddly more true to life than a photograph. You know by now it is one of Claude Monet's lilies, reality molded out of mist. From 1903 to 1909, Claude Monet worked tirelessly at the creation of 48 paintings that would comprise his greatest artistic challenge and his greatest triumph. 48 paintings of the same darn thing. The same place. The same simple, elegant flower. They were 48 paintings of water lilies. And not a great variety of water lilies from all around the world. No! These were just the water lilies that happened to grow in his garden. In the vast majority of these images, there is no shoreline, no encroaching earth to draw one's attention away from that simple, open field of water and flowers. 5 years he spent doing this. 5 years of unceasing effort, and Monet's squinting old eyes never found a reason to look for inspiration at anything grander than a lily. I return in my mind to that painting not because I think lilies are the most important image in the world, or even because Monet is the greatest painter, though I admit I do love those paintings a great deal. I return to that painting and I tell you about it today not because lilies are inherently prettier or more artistically important, more true than anything else, but because that painter, in his commitment to that singular and sublime and mundane subject, achieved what all the great artists of the world, including each of us, aspire to. He achieved relationship with his subject. And in looking at one single thing, he achieved relationship with the whole world. Sitting there, cross-legged on the floor of that grand museum, I saw the beauty in not running away, even from something you have painted 47 times already. I saw the true beauty that can be found only after a long and steady gaze, and it humbled me. For how can you know a thing if you've painted it only once? How can you know a story if you've only heard it in passing? How can you be in relationship with another human being if you don't take the time to look and look and keep on looking? In the world we all know, a world of constant comings and goings, where careers and belief systems and theologies and faiths and loves are picked up and dropped off with the pace of a runaway train, that artist stayed put long enough to really know what he was painting. And it was so much more complicated than a flower. In his own estimation, the exact motif of what he painted did not matter at all. He said, "Other painters paint a bridge, a house, or a boat. I want to paint the air in which the bridge, the house, and the boat are to be found. I want to paint the beauty of the air around them." With a goal like that, even with one single subject, even with a concentrated gaze in one direction, it is possible to never ever get bored. See, the more Monet painted his lilies, the more frustrated he became at his inability to keep up with the constantly changing face of his subject. It was not really a lily he painted. It was the light that landed on the lily. It was the fog that crept in and through its petals. It was, as he said, the air, and it was never, ever the same from one moment to the next. In painting one single subject, Monet came closer than perhaps anyone else to painting everything. Light, dark, shadow, mystery, illusion, color, clarity, shape, everything that makes up this fragile world he painted in those blossoms. And as the sun changed its rays, so changed the painting. And friends, there is, after all, no need for any subject matter beyond everything. The lilies were not just this old artist's insulated obsession. They were the window that he chose to view the vastness of creation through. They were the window that he chose. After looking for so long at one single thing, Monet did what we all must do. He looked past that thing. After looking for so long, the artist no longer painted lilies. The artist painted light. And when we ourselves are vulnerable and patient enough to stick with anything, to know anything, something, someone, some tradition, to know anything through a foundation of loving persistence like that, when we come to know a thing before jumping from curiosity to curiosity, the rewards for our own spirits can be breathtaking too. With vulnerability and with persistence, both we and Claude Monet can see the connective tissue of reality behind almost any motif. The commonality behind the diversity that calls us to be accountable to and in relationship with the world around us. Monet did not have to choose lilies. He could have looked at ice cubes or lace curtains. It does not matter. He could have looked at anything. The important thing was that he looked. He stopped. He looked at one thing. He came to know it, and then and only then could he move beyond it. And such depth as that, an ability to see through the subject and into the infinite, is not accomplished by wandering eyes, by artistic visions that skip like bouncing rubber balls from one location to the next. Lilies are just one interchangeable motif. The truth lies behind them. And so it is with religious metaphors, with religious images. The truth lies behind all of them. And in the mist that lands upon the meditation garden, the light that streams through stained glass windows, even we, if we look and we look and we're patient, can see what lies beyond all these metaphors that ministers and priests and clergy folks around the world cook up. Across the ages, religion has been the story of human beings looking for something, some motif, some image, some story that narrows their focus enough to serve as a window into the greater, a jumping-off place for the real questions that lie beyond all the particulars of every specific faith tradition. French Christian reformer Jacques Lefebvre focused his eyes squarely on the Christian gospel when he said, "To know nothing beyond the gospel is to know everything." And for Lefebvre, as a Christian, that focus through his one Christian window, the scriptures there, allowed him to paint Monet's lilies out of the gospels. When best observed, the religious traditions of the world are the motifs behind which flows the beauty of the air, the light that settles on all, the infinite beyond the particular. And it is possible that the telling and retelling of one story can serve as something other than a boring, stiffening, and controlling force. It is possible that the telling and retelling of one story can be a means of breaking through that story and seeing what lies beyond it. Breaking through the particulars of the old tale and into the myriad ways in which light and love and truth can shine on almost anything if one looks hard enough. I must admit that this is very dangerous work. Religious persons must take the time to know a story, to know a way of life, to know a person before they move on to the next thing. And we must remember that neither Monet's lilies nor the many religious traditions the world over that focus our attention are means in and of themselves, are ends in and of themselves. When religious people forget complexity, when we forget to paint the light and convince ourselves that what was intended as one window among many is the only path to truth, we've let infinity slip away. Some of the paintings I walk by in the Art Institute of Chicago, like the paintings born out of the Italian Renaissance or those Egyptian sarcophagi, some of those artistic creations had their metaphors dictated by a culture that told them how to paint and what to paint. Through those rigid controls, masterpieces were created, lives were changed, movements were born and died. Time and again, faithful the world over have caught their breath in front of yet another image of the crucified Christ. But nobody, no church, no pharaoh, no civil government told Monet he had to paint lilies. He found his metaphor. He found his beauty. He found his window into the sacred by looking at a universe of possibilities and narrowing in on that which moved his own soul to paint. And that, friends, is what we as Unitarian Universalists are called to do. By choosing not to submit to one culturally dominant metaphor that gives us one ready-made lens through which to look at the world, we commit to the hard and challenging work of finding our own inspiration. We are called to focus our gazes according to the pull of our own souls, but that does not get us off the hook of the necessity to focus. So the work is harder in so many ways without the path drawn out for us, without the image of the Lord engraved on a silver platter. We must resist the temptation so often present, so often true, the temptation to skim the surface of everything without diving deeply into anything. Too often, we Unitarian Universalists live up to our critics' label of spiritual tourists. We rub shoulders with other people's metaphors while jumping from one motif to another. But this religious and spiritual potpourri is not our destined lot. Liberal religion, and I've said this before, does not mean that we should live as bouncing balls in our spiritual lives. Like Monet, we simply have to choose our own subjects. And once chosen, we have to be in relationship to those subjects. I get gentle criticism from time to time for being, well, less eclectic than some of you would like me to be. That's the nice way of saying it. For standing up here and wearing this robe every Sunday and asking you to hold hands all the time and saying my particular meditations that always seem to allude to God but are never clear what I'm actually talking about. For being so generally and absolutely myself every single Sunday. And the truth is that most of those criticisms are, well, completely and totally true. But I also know that when I sat there in John's apartment among the blue things, contemplating that print of Monet's lilies, it hit me that I don't have to come up with all the metaphors you'll ever need. I don't have to hand your metaphors to you. I only have to do what you ask of me, to stand here and speak the truth as I see it, to offer up the world through my own eyes, knowing that it's not my job to speak the metaphor that you need in your life, but a metaphor that is true to me, and to offer with that metaphor a humble invitation to go boldly on your own journey. And so, don't ask yourselves every Sunday morning if you just agree or disagree with what I have to say. I may agree or disagree with what I have to say. Don't ask yourselves only if my language or my metaphors or my particular way of doing this thing called church is what works for you. Mine is only one garden, and my words are only my small attempt to paint it and paint it and paint it until I, and maybe we, can see through them and toward the mystery that lies behind all these metaphors. Nobody told Monet to paint lilies. He came up with that all on his own. So ask what metaphors do work for you. Ask what calls your own soul into deeper relationship with the world around you. All I can do is offer up what little glimmers of truth are visible from my small garden. And if I am not eclectic enough, it is because there is only one me, and I have only one garden. And the true tapestry, the spectrum of ideas that lies at the heart of our congregation, is not something that I can offer you. Rather, it is something that only we can create together for ourselves. No one told Monet he had to paint lilies, and no one, certainly not me, can tell you where to look to find your own inspiration. Only you can see the world through your eyes, from your perspective, from your garden. And only you can look deeply enough to find the truth in that which moves your own soul to paint. Monet's lilies, above all else, remind us to cleave tightly to something, to someone, to some place. cleave tightly to some part of yourself, some bit of your faith that has been and will be in the future. Find love and truth in and through the familiar. Find love and truth in and through the mundane bit of your life. Find truth in the blessed every day. Dive deep. Break the surface. Examine the best and the worst of some finite and limited aspect of this creation. Sit quietly in your own garden. And in it, see the reflection of the infinite. Amen.